obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com. Hey.
Well, I've got five bottles of water up here. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Danny.
Hi. How y'all doing?
Good.
I was, too. And I'm glad to be here. I've been here before, but this is one of my favorite places to come. I get to see my friend Dave Barge. I guess you can break your anonymity, Dave B. And Shirali, it's good to see you again. And I want to thank everybody, because you can't name off the people that have something to do with you getting here, because everybody in this thing is like hooked up doing something, and that's just awesome. We don't have quite that much participation, except on the listening and talking from their chair. We have that going on a lot back in Houston. But I will say one guy went to any length, a guy that I'm really close to, that's from my home group, Jason C. from Houston, Texas, is here. And I'm glad to see you here. Anyway, I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since February the 18th of 81. And I'm very grateful for that. Actually, my memory of what happened at the airport and his are a little different. I was standing at the carousel with a lady trying to show this lady how to be patient and wait on your bag. And so she said, mine will probably be the last. And I thought, no, it'll be mine for sure. And so we're standing there, and finally her bag comes, and I keep looking and waiting for mine to come, and then everybody's gone. And I thought, I am so sick of the way that United handles this stuff. And I already had decided what I was going to tell them. And I watched this bag go by. And I waited, and it came by the next time, and I said, yep, that's it. And I asked that guy next to me, I said, how long has that been there? He said, it's about the first bag out. So I let United off the hook and come outside, and hell, he was circling the place. So we got in the car, and we had a good time. He's easy to talk to. He'll believe anything. So he's a lot of fun. I'm a member of the Cypress Wood Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Spring, Texas, and it's a three-legacy group. We really do, we have a good group, and it's on fire, sometimes at each other, but we've got group conscience coming up pretty quick. It's going to be, you know, we're going to paint the club, and that's going to be a big fight. We don't fight much over carrying the message, but man, the striping the parking lot or doing anything like that, that's a big deal, you know. Anyway, I'm married to an alcoholic, and I've been married 7 years last weekend, which is, Shortly after I married, I called Dave and said, what was I thinking? And he didn't say it, but what he meant to say was, you weren't. And I spent a lot, probably the first 2 years that I was married, I was calling him up, and I'd be measuring the garage for a U-Haul trailer, you know. I don't know whether he gave me good information or whether he just rambled on till I lost interest in my resentment and stayed. But I stayed. So suddenly, just like everything else in my life, if I'll just not get in there and fix it, it usually works out. It seems like somebody's always been moving my checkers for me. And that's a really good deal. I love being here. I enjoyed the speaker last night. Angie speaks in just a little while, and she's off the hook, as you well know. I've heard Rick before, and Rick Jatuic. Well, you're an Al-Anon. You can say anything you want. It's one of the greatest Al-Anon speakers, and I kid you not, one of the greatest Al-Anon speakers that I personally have ever heard. And because of Shirali and Dave and people like that, I've had to hear all the Al-Anons. And I'm glad that I did, because they have a good message to carry. I usually tell a story, a joke, because I've got it memorized, and the other is because it really wasn't designed to entertain you. It was just to calm me down, because I am feeling a little nervous all of a sudden. Anyway, let me see if I can remember my joke. Okay, so there was this lady that she walks into a pharmacy, and she goes up to the pharmacist and said, I'd like to buy some arsenic. And the pharmacist said, what for? She said, well, I want to kill my husband. He said, ma'am, you can't come in here and say something like that. They'll put us both in jail. So she reached into her purse and pulled out a picture of his wife and her husband in bed together. He looked at it and he said, well, now that's different. I didn't know you had a prescription. So,
that's pretty good.
Yes. So anyway, it's been a lot of fun being here. I was telling Dave earlier, it's really nice. I was here 10 years ago the first time, and I was really, really nervous and happy to be here. It was just a great, I'd never seen anything like this. This is the doggonedest thing. I've been all over the country, and they just don't do it like this anywhere. This is wonderful. Yeah. But it's nice to come here and see people that I'm not the only one that's lost their hair. You know, we're all a little older and a little slower. And I was realizing something that I don't usually notice in myself is that I'm calmer. You know, I mean, I'm just, and which is, if you know me for any length of time, that's really a good deal. Because, I mean, I'm the kind of guy that people come over that I sponsor, and while they're talking to me, I'm up cleaning house. Because I'm busy. But I'm learning to calm down. My wife, Vicki, is a nurse. I want her to transfer into geriatrics because I'm 13 years older than she is. I thought I was doing really good. She put me on an allowance almost immediately after we got married. And for a while, I had a way around it. I could go to the grocery store and get cash back. But they started giving out the statements, and they'd say, cash. So now I'm on an allowance, and I'm doing better for it, actually. My life is really, really good. We have a big old house with a swimming pool and three dogs. I've got grandkids, which is really cool because I've never been a father. And, you know, it's kind of nice to just skip that step because I understand that it can be really difficult. And I like the grandkids. You know, they're little guys, and they like me because I'm not really that much different than they are. I got a very short attention span. You know, I wander around pretty quick, but they're a lot of fun, and it's a good life, a life that I certainly wasn't going to have. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, before I do that, the basket. Thank you. I've gained 3 pounds, and great basket. I love it. Whoever did it, thank you, thank you, thank you, and. Thank you guys for the tickets and all that. Well, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous sometime in the fall of 1979. And I call that my been-around date. That's when I first came in and met you guys. And I call it my been-around date because I didn't get sober till February of 81. But I would come to AA fairly regularly. I would, I was a running drunk. I'd get drunk here and wind up in another town, go to an AA club and borrow money and get a new sponsor, and I'd always get in a chip. You know, anybody need a desire chip, and I'd come in and get one, or get a 30-day chip. Sometimes I'd get a 90-day chip just because I was tired of my 30-day chips. I wasn't at the stage where honesty was really that important in my particular walk, but I remember people come up to you all the time and they'd say, "Now, how long have you been sober this time?" And I didn't want them to think I didn't know what was going on. You know, I've been going to AA for a while, and I'd say, well, I've been sober this time, but I've been around since 1950, you know. I don't want anybody to think I don't know what's going on, even though I was getting drunk all the time, but that's entirely different. I still know the third step prayer by heart. But I was riding around in an old beat-up stolen car when I came to AA. I was wearing an eye patch, And wasn't anything wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really cool, you know. And I had a big scraggly beard, and I was skinny. My liver was swollen, and that old car was a stolen car, but it was a terrible car. The guy didn't even want it back, you know. It was just, you know, poor STP in it, and just ride around and couldn't get it registered, so it was always tearing up little pieces of paper and sticking up there so they couldn't tell that my car wasn't registered. And I was on parole, and I had not reported to my parole officer in quite some time because I didn't have anything good to report. And I was married, not to my wife I have now, but I was married, and things were just not going well. She had a boyfriend, and I just hated it because I thought that was really going to ruin our marriage. And so we got together one night, and, you know, I found her in a bar. And we decided to have a talk. And 3 days later, and I don't know how much whiskey, we were almost through talking. And she just kicked me out of the car in front of this nondescript-looking building. And I wanted to stay and finish our counseling session, but she drove off and she left me in front of this building in Midland, Texas. It was the 710 Club of AA. And she didn't know it was AA, and I didn't either. I didn't even know really what AA was about. It was before cell phones, and I needed to use the phone to, you know, call a friend and save my marriage. So I walked into this building, stuck my head in the door, and there were some people sitting over in the corner smoking cigarettes and playing gin, and when they saw me, they were very happy to see me. They invited me in and started offering me orange juice and honey and just, you know, talking to me a lot and wanting to know all about me. And I just said, I need to use the phone. And they just kept me busy. And finally they said, look, if you'll stay for a meeting, we'll give you a ride afterwards. So I said, okay. So I stayed for the meeting, and it was a call-up meeting. They would just call people, come up to the podium. They would say a few words and sit down. And, you know, when that meeting was over, everybody stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And this was in the smoking days, so when they stood up, it just looked like a haze out there. You could just see legs mostly, you know, except for the people close to you. And when they got through praying, that place just erupted into laughter, everybody talking at the same time. And I was over by the kitchen, and I began to feel that thing I always feel. In the big book, it says, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic becomes restless, irritable, and discontent till he can experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. I never said that to myself. When I was out there, I would start saying, I got to go. You know, I would start to get anxious. My foot start patting. My head start racing, and I'm backing out. And I just started backing towards the door, and it seemed to me like it probably wasn't this way, but to me it seemed like that place parted like the Red Sea. And here came a little dour-looking guy with a flat top, and he had a young guy with him. They were heading right straight for me. I saw him, and I thought, oh, hell no, I ain't going anywhere with him. And he walked up to me, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go? And I thought, Baskin Robbins for ice cream. Be still my beating heart. In my mind, what I thought was, there is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth is, sure, I'd love to go. So I wound up over at Baskin-Robbins eating a melting Rocky Road ice cream while these guys pitched me on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember early on asking people, going to people, asking them, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And almost to a T, they would, everyone seemed to start talking about themselves. You know, I'd say, what do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he'd start telling me all about himself, and I'd think, good Lord, did you not hear me? I don't care. I'm not talking about you. It's me that we're worried about. I kept up doing that. My mom had joined Al-Anon. She was all, and she found out that I had accidentally got dropped off at AA. She found out what it was. She joined Al-Anon, and immediately they taught her a bad word. It was no. And it cut off one of my main revenue streams, you know. And and she started going to all those Al-Anon and AA conferences and open meetings. Now, I didn't bother with it that much. I was a very busy person. I didn't have a job. I owed everybody money, and if when I did go to meetings, I was always late. I needed to leave early because I was busy. And I don't know why we're like that, but that's the way my life was. My mom, though, she was going early, staying late, going to people's houses, gathering up big books to hide wherever she thought I might show up. And one night I had got drunk, and I'd split up with that gal, and I pulled the couch away from her. We had gotten married, and one of the gifts was from my side of the family. It was a couch, and she was having a party. I went upstairs and told them I wanted my couch. So we pushed it over the railing, and I put it in the back of the truck and took off, and I came to in a cornfield right outside my dad's house. And I went in the houses on a Sunday morning, and I'm thirsty and hungover, and there was a little cassette player sitting there, and my mother had been to the Hub of the Plains conference, and there was a cassette from Johnny H. And I put that cassette in, I don't know why to this day, and I started to play it. And I probably didn't play for 5 minutes, and I was crying. Because just about everything that he said, everything that he felt, the experiences that he had, that had been my truth. That's where that had been the way my life had rolled. That didn't stop me from drinking at that time, but it sure did put a little spiritual bomb inside of me where from that point forward, I always knew that I didn't have to keep this up. Somehow, some things could change, and it could change for me too. I'll tell you a little bit about how I got to that point. I was, my folks were married on Valentine's Day, 1944. My mother was 14, my dad was 19. They had me a year later. We just all grew up together. And if they did that now, my mother would be in Child Protective Services, my dad would be in jail and on a list of people to watch out for. And probably I'd belong to one of you, you know. But that was a different time. Now, they had three boys, and I'm the oldest. And I used to drink at them thinking, I was really mad at my folks because I thought they should have been older before they had me. But my folks were married 65 years when my dad died. Never gave up. I asked my dad, I said, Is that the way it is with us? I said, how'd you do that? He said, sometimes we just didn't have the money to go. He said, I said, so what is the secret to it? He said, son, it's commitment. You know, my dad lived by that. He believed in it, his word was his bond. My dad was in the Navy in the Second World War, and he went out and fought in the Pacific, and when he came back, he was twisted up from the things that had happened. We lived in South Texas, and when he came back, he turned to the bottle and he'd drink and party, and to me, he was a lot of fun. I mean, he'd come in a good mood and we'd play out in the backyard. He'd listen to country music and play with me and throw me up in the air. And I remember him catching me and holding me to his bare chest and patting my head and me feeling on a visceral level that all is well in my world. I'm with my father. Nothing can hurt me. My mom's experience was not that at all. My mom was putting up with the where's the money, him staying out all night drinking, him yelling and screaming at her. And she said she was going to leave him, take me and leave him. And he didn't want to lose his family, so he just quit drinking. But when he quit drinking, he turned to work, and he just shut off everything else in his life. And he became like a workaholic. I mean, he was short-tempered. The guy that I was close to and loved had just disappeared, and I didn't know what had gone wrong. I got two younger brothers. They're much, much younger than I am. But as I grew up alone, thinking, I was just a restless kid. I was always agitated, prone to depression, didn't make friends easy. When we went to school, I always just felt like I just need to get out of here. By the time I got to middle school, I'd been to about six different schools because we moved all the time. And we went in and they played a film that was called Duck and Cover. And that's a film that they played to show you what to do in case a nuclear bomb goes off in your neighborhood. And, you know, and it's, in case you don't know, what you do is you get your biggest book, you go out into the hallway, and you duck down and cover your head. And I don't think they were smiling, but close to it. And then the nuclear bomb goes off, buildings collapse, and I wasn't their best student, and I knew that was woefully inadequate. And so when we came out of that, everybody else was going off to do whatever kids do, except for me. I got to go. I'm concerned about national security. I got to get out of here. And I started taking off on a dead run, and they'd arrest me and bring me back. I wound up in Big Spring State Hospital, Clancy's Hospital. And I stayed there for 90 days, came back. Was at my mom's house, and she couldn't keep me in school. And I stole her car one night and went down to where all the cool kids hang out. And I got a pack of cigarettes. I didn't smoke, but I got a pack of cigarettes and rolled up in my sleeve because that's what they did. And took that car, which was a station wagon. It's not a cool car at all. And I drive down to where they are, and here's the coolest guy in school, and he's got a lowered 58 Chevy. His nickname is Batman. And he's drinking beer and has girls around smoking cigarettes, and I got to go. But he saw me, and he called me over, and one thing led to another, and I just felt so, self-conscious and ashamed. And I don't know why, I just did. And they got me to smoke a cigarette, and they finally talked me into taking a drink, and I don't know what drink it happened, but it happened that night that I just came unglued, man. It's just like I could relax. I felt good. I could have fun. I started telling people what I really thought. That night, I got into a fight. I got my nose broke. I wrecked my mother's car. I puked on myself. At least I hope it was me. And I wound up in juvenile detention. And, the next morning, my folks got me out. I'm back at their house. I got my first hangover, my head spinning, and they're talking about sending me back to Big Spring State Hospital, and I'm thinking I'm never drinking with those guys again. They got me in a lot of trouble. They sent me back to the hospital, and I immediately escaped. They brought me back and threatened me with shock treatments if I tried that again. So I'm sitting up there weaving baskets, and I make my first two close friends, who are a couple of guys who are getting shock treatments. And, we became buddies. But they were getting shock treatments, and they were kind of losing it. And so one day I got an opportunity, and I stole a car that a lady left her keys in, and I had managed to get out. And I got those guys out, and we escaped. And we went from Big Springs to about 35 miles over to Midland, and picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And we then headed south for Mexico. I now have a plan. We're going to Mexico. That'll solve everything. And my wife today will tell you I'm not a detail-oriented person. I'm pretty much a big picture guy. We're going to Mexico. That's the deal. And it's very, this was turned out to be a really, really heady and exciting experience. This is my first gang. I'm their leader. cops are looking for us. We're in a stolen car. I'm really jazzed. I'm the kind of guy, I think even back then, I was the kind of guy that would just like shoot arrows into a wall and then go paint bullseyes around them. And then just back up and congratulate myself on being a good shot. And I'm going to open one of my five waters. It's really faulty thinking. They discover that when you get to AA that you're like that too, by the way. So anyway, we're heading south. We haven't got any money. We've stopped in mom and pop stores and go in and create a diversion so we could steal booze and supplies and when you're escaped mental patients, creating a diversion is really not that hard. I mean, it was pretty easy deal. But as we're heading south, those two guys I got out of the hospital, their meds began to wear off. And it became clear they were in that hospital for a reason. It became increasingly more difficult for me to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. It was kind of like herding cats, you know. But we got across the border and to Villacuña, Mexico, and I sold that car to a taxi driver for a few hundred pesos, which is not a lot of money, I found out. It sounded like a lot, and it was a big stack. So we get over there, we go to Boys Town, and I'm sitting at the Cadillac bar with my gang, and we're having a drink. And this is when I realize I'm out of plan. I have no clue what to do from here. And about that time, there was a big fight started because one of the guys that had come with me had killed a parrot that belonged to a lady that worked down there. He thought it said something ugly to him, you know. So it started a big fight, and the local police and the federales started coming our way. I grabbed these guys and said, we've got to get back to Texas. And we ran for the border, and they caught us on the Mexican side, and we went to jail in Mexico.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
That's what I said. You know, again, in the big book, it says, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic's problem pile up on him and become astonishingly difficult to solve. This is one of those instances that bore that truth out. Because I'm not bilingual. I have no idea how to tell these people I want my mother, you know. Yeah. Oh. We're at a biker meeting and everybody's all pumped up, tatted up, and have ride scooters, but I can guarantee you, I've drank with you, run with you, and rode with you, and when you're in trouble, you don't call me, you call your mama. That's just the way it is, because she'll come through, you know. But my mom, I had no idea how, to this day, I don't know how she found me. She's even tried to tell me, I don't think she knows, but she found me. She came and got me out, left them in there because they were a bad influence on me. And we rode back the 240 miles in a 55 Mercury, and she would dial that AM radio looking for Mexican music, and when she'd find it, she'd turn it all the way up. And it'd just be blaring, and she'd start quoting scripture and trying to shame me. It was her attempt at aversion therapy, It worked. I hate that music to this day. We got back home to my folks' house, and we had a family meeting. Actually, it was my mom and dad talking and me just doing this, watching them. My dad said, you know, I think he should join the Navy. They'll make a man out of him. And I wanted to say, I have a bulletin for you. I'm an escaped mental patient. But it apparently did not bother the Navy at all. That should make you feel safer. I joined the Navy on what was known as the Kitty Cruise the day I turned 17. I became a CB and I grew big and strong. I loved being in the military. I didn't like some of the things that they like for you to do, like get up early. And I didn't like, everybody else seemed to have a say in what I do. But I like wearing a uniform and being in the company of men. I'm very patriotic, and if you served in the military or are serving for our country, God bless you and thank you. It's the greatest thing in the world. I appreciate you. I didn't wind up aboard a ship. I was a CB. I don't even know what you do on a ship, but I was a construction man, and I grew big and strong, and I was a two-fisted drinker. And I could put it away. And for a while I was having fun, but then all of a sudden it got to where it was really hard to predict what kind of fun am I going to have. I mean, I could start crying, which would make me mad, or I might just get in a fight, or I may decide I need to go somewhere. And the Navy, they're not for that at all, you know. And so, you know, and I'm blacking out, you know. I'm missing things, and I don't know what's going on. And I'm not telling anybody this. I'm watching everybody else, and it looks to me like they're doing fine. They get drunk, they have fun, they get in fights, they go to work the next day. I get drunk, I'm very likely to wind up in the brig because I won't come back. Or I'll black out and I don't know what happened. And I would be afraid because you start to examine yourself and your surroundings. What happened? What did I do? What happened to me? And so I'm getting more and more isolated, and I less and less communicate with anybody. And I quit drinking tequila, and I started drinking only beer. And that didn't work, and I drank tequila again. And so it's just, you know, we're island hopping around the Pacific, and I'm becoming more isolated and neurotic. And I don't know what's wrong. But I got to, finally it came to a head in Guam. I got drunk with some British sailors, and they invited me to their ship. And I got passed out, and they went to sea. And so they knew they had a stowaway. It was pretty easy to figure out who wasn't British. And so I wound up, you know, I wasn't that far out. I mean, it's not like we were around the world. They sent a skiff out and got me and brought me back. And I, you know, get a captain's mast, and we get back to the States, and I go AWOL. And it's just, everything's falling apart. You know, I can't be where I want to be. I want to be in this. I want to do this. I want to make my family proud. I love my country. I want to be part of my battalion. But I just can't stay. I just can't follow through with anything. And I took off, and they brought me back, and I attempted suicide. I slashed my wrist. I don't know if I was just trying to get attention, get out of trouble, or if I was serious. I know I was a screwed up kid. I was an alcoholic. And they did a little investigation and found out that I was an escaped mental patient, that the Navy had made a really bad deal. And they gave me a general discharge under honorable conditions. And so after about 2 years, I was set free on the streets of Los Angeles and Hollywood. And I walked the streets of L.A. and I learned to lie, cheat, steal, and hustle, and sell plasma rather than blood. I learned how to scuffle, and made it out of here. Went back to Midland, Odessa, where I'm from, and my dad had a business. He tried to give me a job, but I was so out of control and unpredictable that he fired me, and I started hanging out at a biker bar, and I met some guys that were stealing out of the oil field, and they had it all going on. They needed some help, and I applied for the job. And pretty soon, you know, we're all ripping and running and got money and it looks good. And first thing you know, the Texas Rangers show up and everybody got arrested. They all went to prison but me, because I didn't have any felonious problems in the state of Texas. I got a probation. And they said, if you'll just live down the terms of your probation and stay away from these folks and pay back this money, this will be expunged from your record, and it'll be a difficult lesson, but you'll go on to have a normal life. I really wanted to do that. I mean, I'm sitting in jail, and I know a lot of you have. You sit in jail, and you're really serious. I mean, they call it jailhouse conversion. But we all know, sitting on this side of the bars, that ain't going to last. But over there, it does feel like that's, you know, this time I've had enough. This time I understand I'm not going to do it. And my dad came the only time he ever come to talk to me. He said, what in the world's wrong with you? And I said, I don't know, Dad, but I want to straighten up. And he said, well, I'm going to help you get a job. And I got a job pumping gas, and I lasted 3 weeks. You know, I was pumping this gas for this guy, and he was sitting in his car, and I remember thinking, you're an idiot. You can pump your own gas. And I went into the cash register and made a cash advance. Went across the street to the bar and took a drink. When I came to, I was 300 miles away in Dallas, Texas. And so we're ripping and running in Dallas. I find the same kind of people, do the same thing. I'm drinking and running and stealing, and I get arrested, and I got 13 five-year sentences, and I was sent to the Texas Department of Corrections. And my take, I'll tell you a little bit about prison from my viewpoint, and that is that it's very time-consuming. I'm sure there's a lot of other things we learn in there, but that's pretty much it. But I didn't drink when I was in prison because the consequences were immediate and severe. And I didn't do drugs. I just stayed in prison and got sicker. Because you got untreated alcoholism, no higher power, no booze, no nothing, just me. And I came out of prison worse than when I went in, I think. I mean, I was pretty bad, but it seemed to me I was worse. My mom come to get me, and we're all excited, I've been writing her letters. It's going to be better. She comes and gets me, and I mean, I'm feeling great. I had decided I would not drink whiskey anymore except on special occasions. Getting out of prison's pretty special. So I'm drinking. We got a 350-mile trip back. I'm drinking, and it's one of those. I had one of those drunks where I was in the zone the whole way. I mean, I just don't think I ever felt better. I mean, we're building houses and having families, and just my mom's in a great mood. And she looked at me and she said, "Son, what you need is a wife, a kid, a car, a bank account, a job, and a house. You'll be okay." So I started looking for a woman that had kids, a bank account, a job, and a car. I found her, and my mother was wrong. That was the worst 2 weeks of my life. I left that woman, and I'm hanging out in downtown Odessa just partying, doing what I do. You're just living on the streets. I don't hold down a job. I drink. I chase. I chase around. I play pool. I just hustle. And one day there's a lady came in to my bar and she's sitting over the corner crying, and I went over to console her. And as we're drinking and talking, I find out that she's pregnant and she can't go home. In those days, there was a social stigma attached to being an unwed mother. She couldn't go home. Her folks wouldn't have her back pregnant. So we hatched a plan that we would just get married. We made the plan that night. The state of Texas, though, they want to be sure you're in love, so you have to wait 3 days. So 3 days later, we still loved each other. We got married. I was drunk that night, and I called my mom. I said, "Mom, I'm married." And she said, "Well, I know you are." I said, "Well, I don't know how you could. I just did it." And she said, "Oh, my God, you have a wife." And I thought, details. I am always getting tripped up. But I decided to go ahead and go on my honeymoon, and we got on a Greyhound bus and took this trip to McAllister, Oklahoma. We got there, we just lit, and my father-in-law shows up, my new father-in-law. He's got a chauffeur-driven limousine, and obviously well-heeled, and we went to his house, lots of bedrooms, big mansion. I go upstairs and pass out. And when I came to, I went downstairs out onto the veranda, as they call it, and I looked out across this great big yard that he had, and I saw the McAllister State Penitentiary. And I had married the warden's daughter. I was very uncomfortable in that relationship. So I absconded. That means to move in a secret way. I went back to Odessa, and I'm back at Odessa, working on Plan B. And about this time, my life just took a turn for the worse. Been doing pretty good up till now. I met a little old girl that we were in love. We were in love. You don't usually fall in love at that depth until you get to a treatment center. It's just. But my drinking and my behavior is so out of control, and I'm dangerous to be around. I'm abusive. And after a couple of years with me, she took off. She couldn't, she couldn't take it anymore. She had to be away to take care of herself. And while she was out doing whatever she was doing, she was killed in a car wreck. And I don't have any tools for dealing with anything like this. I feel guilty. I feel angry. I started blaming her. I blamed the guy that she was with that got killed. It wasn't my fault, but I heard over it, and I just picked up a gun and a bottle, and I went on a crime spree, and I got 10 years, and I was sent back to penitentiary. And while I was in penitentiary this time, I did everything that I knew how to do to try to turn my life around. I got an education. I took up yoga. I read voraciously. I learned to meditate. I did everything I could. I've made up my mind. My problem is I'm a criminal. And that's a big problem, by the way. But that's it. Really, it's just like I've worked on so. I can't tell you in my life, even in sobriety, how many times I have worked on a problem, and it really turned out to be a symptom of another problem. And the problem has always been primary, permanent, progressive. It was alcoholism. Under everything else that was going on in my world, that was the thing that needed to be addressed. And I didn't know that. I was always picking off this thing and that thing and this woman and that woman. And if I move over here, if I drink only that, I'll be okay. And I got out of penitentiary, and, I got a job with my dad, and I was doing better than I ever had in my life. I drank only on weekends, and sometimes I had a long weekend. And I needed to be married. So I found a girl. She was dancing on top of a table. When I saw her, I knew that was her. And it took about 3 months, but we got married. And I'm going to tell you what, I made a very bad choice. She was a lot worse than I was. She'd carry out the trash, be gone 3 days. And, man, she was a bartender. I had to quit my job, stay up and guard her all the time. My little life that I was putting together was falling apart. And I quit my job. I'm hanging out at the bars. And all of a sudden, I'm doing everything that I promised myself I'd never do again. I promised myself this time it's going to be different, and I'm stuck. I'm back to hanging with the same people. I've got the same drinking patterns, I've gotten to the point where I want to just snort speed, drink whiskey, and just, I like to pop the clutch and smell the rubber. And I'm in a lot, I got my backs to the wall, and I got sick, I got hepatitis, and, I don't know what's going on. I know I'm on my way back to prison. I know that that's the only place that I ever even thrived was actually in prison. On the streets, I'm a loser, and I don't know what to do. She left me, and she's the one that dropped me off in front of that AA club. And I met you guys. I really didn't have anything else to do, so I just adopted you. I'd go to your meetings. I loved you. I loved you. I loved the stories. You guys were so funny, and you were so nice. You'd take time. You always were glad to see me. And I would think, man, I wish I were an alcoholic. This would be this would be such a good deal, man, because, if that was the problem. But, that was obvious to me that was, over-drinking may have been a little bit of a problem, but I have lots of other stuff. I'm an escaped mental patient. Which, by the way, I've been remiss. If you're new here in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, welcome to AA. Welcome to the fastest growing organization in the world that no one wants to join. And I wouldn't put too much stock in what this speaker says, because I'm still an escaped mental patient. We have a book, and I highly recommend reading the book. Get you a sponsor. Get you a home group, get a commitment. You'll be amazed if you just stay, you don't drink, and you just try your best. I heard it out here long ago. AA is monkey see, monkey do. And, man, you just got to get a monkey that's got a good bunch of bananas. You don't want one that's chasing those girls around, a little skinny monkey. You won't turn out good for you at all. But I've been blessed in that. Anyway, I don't even know where I was. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I'm just going from one club to the other, back and forth, and life's falling apart. And finally, I was in Austin, Texas, and I came to in the back seat of that old car. And I was sick as a dog. I had 3 old Milwaukee beers left. And I just leaned out of that car and puked bile and blood. And I said, God, I'd do anything if I could just get sober. And two guys came to get me from the Northland Club in Austin. And it was a guy who'd been to, he'd been to pick me up before. His name was John Henry. He became my sponsor. And John Henry brought a young guy with me, and he come pick me up, and I'm riding back to the club. We left that car there, and I said, John, what am I going to do? He said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, well, how do you do that? He said, well, don't drink right now. And then when it's right now again, don't drink then either. And that kid said, yeah, and pretty soon you'll have like a minute. And but John said, don't listen to him, because the minutes, and it's true, the minutes become weeks, months, years. You join us in this thing and do what we do, and you find yourself a changed person, a sober, self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with a message to carry and a life worth living and a relationship with the power that, in my view, created and runs this universe. And it's a good deal. I didn't have friends. I was talking to Tim earlier about going to high school reunions, and I said, what for? I didn't know any of them, you know. I didn't have old friends. The people that I ran with were killed, you know. And I came here, and here you are. And I wasn't even that friendly at the time. I was kind of ticked off. But it's so cool, because you didn't care. You know, it's kind of like a challenge to you to get some angry guy to smile. Oh, what's up with that? You know. But you're good at it, and I'm glad you are, because I stayed. I tell you, my early days in AA, I was smitten with a magnificent obsession for sobriety. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what it was going to take. I didn't know what I ought to do. But I was at that club, parked out front every day. And I would go in and help them set up for the day and clean up. And the old timers were there, and they began to see that I was serious. And they'd say, you're doing good, kid. And one of them got me a cassette player, and they got me a bunch of CDs. That's where I found out about all the speakers in the world come from California. And, but they're great. They were energized, and they were happy, and they were telling the story that started in despair and ended in hope. And man, I would just ride around and listen to that. And it's just awesome. But I really didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I remember hearing them say in meetings all the time, let go and let God. And I thought, let go and let God do what? And that thought spun me out. And I thought, John Henry will know. Because I thought John Henry knew everything. I'd call him up and say, John, I've been thinking. And he said, Dan Brown, avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery, but when trouble comes along, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. I thought, wow, I wonder why I didn't think of that. I just shot right in there, you know. And I thought, man, that dude is deep and he's cool. I didn't know he just had a good memory and read the big book. But I drove up to that club and I saw him standing there, and I looked at him, I said, John, I'm an alcoholic. He said, well, yeah, you are. He said, come on in this house. And I came in, and we went inside, and we got down on our knees, and we said the third step prayer. And I wrote an inventory, and I hid it all over that car, you know, because I was scared death somebody would find it. And when I finally shared it, you know, I had this wonderful spiritual experience. I mean, it was just, I just felt like the whole universe opened up and shined its light on me. And I knew that I would never have to drink again or live like that if I didn't insist on it. And I wanted to go down and start chairing meetings, and I became a big 12-stepper. But I was also one of those guys, because of that spiritual awakening and my own personal thinking, I was amazed before I was halfway through. And that's a promise. That's in the promises. You're not supposed to get amazed just because you had a little touch from God. I decided that I would not do the rest of the steps, because in my case, there was a lot of things that no one needed to know, and we just need to start over. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing? That's me. And so I'm living underground in AA in that car, and I'm a 12-stepping fool. I go to lots of meetings. I'm happy. I borrow money. I'm living in my car, and I'm as happy as I've ever been. But about 6 months into it, I begin to have meltdown, and that old I gotta go is back, and my head's racing. And I can't take it anymore. And I called John Henry and I said, John, I want a drink. He said, meet me at the club. And I met him at the club and he said, Danny, what's standing between you and that God that you met when you did your inventory are the things that are on your 8-step list. I said, well, there's some things I didn't tell you. And he said, what are they? And I shared a couple of them, and then I told him what at that time seemed to be the big one. I said, it was a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas, in the summer of 1980. They have it on videotape, and they have a warrant for my arrest. And my parole officer is looking for me. He said, well, son, you've got to go in and clean that up. I said, oh, no. No, 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 no. He said, you told me that you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that's theory. This is serious business here. They will lock me up the rest of my life. He said, well, you better get another sponsor, son, because you will not make it with that. And I sat out in that car, and I just had that sinking feeling, and it just, you know, you just like, crap, I got to run again. And I said, God, I don't have the courage to do it. If you want me to do it, you're going to have to help me. And I had this an epiphany and an experience that I can't explain again. And it's just that I realized that four walls do not make a prison. Prison is something you carry around on the inside of you. And I had the keys to the kingdom. And I could get up and take off and run like I always had, or I could follow your example and be willing to surrender my physical freedom to have this gift. And the next day, I went down to the robbery department in Austin, and I parked that car a long ways off. And I walked in there and I told them who I was. They brought me upstairs. They wanted to know where I'd been. And I gave them my very best AA pitch. And he played that video. And it was grainy, about 15 seconds long. And, you know, the guy was with a beard, tall and skinny, going from till to till. And the second time he played it, my heart sunk. And I thought, I wonder what I did with the money. Because I'm a blackout drinker, I know I was in the area, and it sure looked to me like it was me. And guys like me don't get out of things like that. And he turned around and looked at me, and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. The guy I'm looking for is out there. And he said, we'll find him. But you need to get your skinny butt back to AA, and maybe you can do something about the mess you've created. I said, I'm in AA forever. You know. I'm not afraid of amends anymore. I'll do yours, you know. And what a ride it's been. And I tried to make amends to my dad. My dad and I were, when I was, like I told you, we were tight. I was his firstborn. And over the years, I'd violated everything that he held near and dear. And when you'd talk to my dad about me, they said, he'd ask, how's Danny? And he'd say, Danny who? And I went back to try to make amends to him. And he said, that's fine, son. Let's get on with life. You know, he didn't want to talk about that. He didn't want to hear it. And I didn't either. And it just got swept under the rug. And we rocked along for many, many, many years. And I would ask you, how do I ever make this right with him? And you said, you continue to be a good son. Continue to do the things that you've been taught here. Be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Carry this message. Live a day at a time. Don't drink in between meetings. It's very hard on your sobriety. Always remember, we did not sober up an innocent man. You're the guy. And I stayed, and I was back in Midland, Texas, right at 20 years sober. And I had I'd gone back to see a guy that I'd been in business with, and I had some dealings with him. And I went to a meeting, and I came home. My mom was waiting up on me just like always. I came into the meeting, and I saw my dad in his bedroom. He was in bed, and time had worn him down. He wasn't this big, strong, handsome man anymore. He was in his 80s, and he was bald-headed, and just he'd given his all for his family and his country. And I asked my mom, I said, is he awake? And she said, he's just pretending to be asleep. And I walked into the room, and on the impulse, I leaned down and kissed him on his old bald head. And before I pulled up, he reached up and pulled my head to his bare chest. And he patted my head, and he said, I didn't know what to do, boy. And I said, me neither, Pop. He said, those people in AA, he said, I hope you'll always remember to tell them how much we appreciate what they've done for our family, what they've done for you. And, yeah. And I have, I had a lot of baggage. We get here, we have a lot of baggage. And I want to say this before I sit down. I don't want to wind up in On and On Anonymous. It may have been Dave, but it was somebody with some cute saying told me that when I started speaking a little bit, he said, you know, you never have to be alone in AA again as long as you don't talk longer than an hour. And I think it was Dave. So I don't want to be alone. I had a lot of baggage. You know, I'm a mental patient, and, you know, to the joint twice. And I'm not good marrying material. Doesn't even look like I'm going to be able to marry my meal ticket. I mean, what am I going to do? And John Henry would tell me, you quit referring to yourself as what you were. You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sky's the limit. You can have and do anything you're willing to pay the price for. He said, if the door's shut, God will direct you in another one. But always look up and always believe in yourself and believe what we do here. He said, these things happened among us. They will happen for you. And I'm sitting in that car and thinking, not anytime soon. And but I'm telling you that as time has gone on, little by slow, I have wound up. I own my own business, I don't own the own thing. I'm a partner in a business. I have some employees. I've done well enough to go bankrupt before. I got that going for me, you know. And I wish I'd have known Rick back then. Rich would have helped me out. But, you know, it was 9 years ago that shortly after I spoke here, that I went bankrupt. And man, it was devastating because I had been that business was my baby. You know, you said I could have this, and then I ran it into the ground, and I was like, I need to blame some political leader for this. But turns out I was always spending more than I was making, and so I wound up going to Houston, Texas, 9 years ago, on a job for 3 weeks, and I'm going to work for a guy that now owns a business that I used to own. You know that story, right? Well, this guy also used to be a member of AA, but he's not now, and he's doing really good. And he called me and he said, I need some help. Would you go to Houston and work for me for a three-week job? And I needed money. I went to Houston with a folding chair. I didn't even like to tell you all this. A rented TV, from a big TV, by the way, a rented big TV from Aaron's. And I'm in what they called a Manny van. Not cool at all, a Chrysler, and I'd made a good deal on it. I was like triple upside down in it, and I'm 26 years sober and about to go speak in Thailand. I mean, everybody needs my message, and I get over there and I gave it my all. I got over there and I thought, you know what? I'm here for 3 weeks. I'm gonna give him 100%. I did him a really good job. I mean, I put my heart into it. I found a little group, and I went to that group. And he came up to me, and he said, if you give me a five-year commitment, I'll give you 30% of the business, and you can make a very nice salary. And I said, well, I'm not doing a lot. I guess I can do that. And I stayed. And I'm 9 years into my five-year commitment. I met Vicky when I married her, and I'm going to tell you what, in Houston, actually, I'm known as Mr. Vicky Brown. My brother met my wife, and Dave has too. My brother met my wife, and he said, son, she can do better, and you can't. My dad said, she's a keeper, son. And she is. She's a lot of fun. She loves Jason. He's stayed at our house from time to time, and she's just a wonderful gift from God. And I'm grateful to have her in my life. I tell you this and I shut up. My dad died 4 years ago. And I got a call when I was at the meeting, and they said, my brother said, you better come, your dad's dying. And I said, oh, I can't do that. You know, that's too raw for me. And there was a guy in the men's meeting. He walked out and he, named Bill G, and he just walked up and he said, "Danny, go get on the plane and go. And when you get there, you call us. And when you go in the room and it gets too hard, you come out, you say a little prayer, and you call us." And the guys that I sponsored would call me and say, "You can do this." And I went down there, and Vicky went with me. My dad adored Vicky. My dad was the bowling champion of the retirement center. He couldn't get up, but he could bowl 300 just sitting there. And I knew he loved Vicky because he got her own remote, you know. And when we got there, my dad was really sick. He had had emphysema, and he'd gotten pneumonia. He saw Vicky come in the room. He reached over in the glass, got his teeth out, put it in. And she said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "Better now that you're here." And I talked to my dad for a while, and I said, "Dad, I'm really sorry." And he said, "I don't know what for, son." He said, "I'm proud of you. You know, there's nothing to be sorry for. And what a nice gift that you give me. I was there when he died, and I'm going to tell you that I can't ask for a better gift than that, to be holding him like he was holding me." Alcoholics Anonymous has done everything that I never dreamed could happen for me, and I know it'll do it for you. If you're here and you're new, just don't give. We used to say, I think everything comes from California. Like they say, don't give up before the miracle, and don't give up after it either. I'm glad to be here. I love you, and thanks for letting me share. Hey, buddy.
Thanks. Let's hear it for Danny.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.